Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a podcast all about music, music production, and the music business. My guests today are Jay and Chandler Coyle from Music Geek Services, a consulting company that specializes in direct-to-fan management. But first, let's talk about the 1,000 True Fans theory. Now, for those of you who don't know, there's a theory in the new millennia in Music 4.0 that we're in that basically states that if you have 1,000 true fans and you can get them to spend $100 a year apiece, that means there's $100,000 of income coming in, and it's a way that an artist could make a decent middle-class living. And the middle-class living is just off their music. This makes a lot of sense, but there's been a lot of pushback on this theory saying, how can you be sure that 1,000 fans is the right number? And could it happen with 500 fans? Maybe it has to be 5,000 fans. Well, it doesn't really matter about the number. The theory basically is that you need a core group of fans that will support you. This doesn't matter whether you're an artist starting out in the garage and on the lowest level possible, or if you're a superstar, there's still a core group of fans that will buy everything that you make, that will want to listen to everything, that think that you're so important in life that they'll follow you anywhere. And that's exactly what we're trying to develop. There are some things about the 1,000 True Fan Theory that we have to go over, because in order to understand the concept completely, you have to understand a few things. First of all, the $100,000 figure, the one that's sort of pulled out of thin air. What that means is that's the gross income that you're going to make in a year. So that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make any more money than if you're working at McDonald's. What it means is that hopefully your expenses are such that there's enough money left over. But if you have high expenses, then that's not going to cover it. So once again, whatever that figure is that you think you can make from your core group of fans, remember, that's only the gross figure. The other thing is you can't be sure that each fan is going to spend $100 a year. Now, you're going to find some that are going to spend more, and you're going to find some that are going to spend less. But hopefully the average is somewhere around $100 a year that they'll spend. Now, again, that's assuming that you can actually supply enough product during the year. Now, if you only have one piece of product, if you only have a CD or a t-shirt that you're selling during the year, of course, you're not going to get $100 from them. If you're constantly touring and you're touring someplace that they can come and see you, if you have a supply of new product always coming out, then you increase your chances of getting that X amount, that $100 a year, whatever it might be. It might be that your fans don't have the money and they'll average much less than that. It could be that you have a lot of fans in territories like Russia, for instance, or in South America that bootleg things. So they may be your fans and they may be avid, but the fact of the matter is they're not spending money. You're not seeing that money. So you have to take all that into account. The third thing is, they don't have to all be in the United States. Once upon a time, we're talking about your core group of fans. We would think they're all in one territory, but now basically we're citizens of the world. We're products of the world. And the world is our marketplace. So you have to figure that your marketplace is just not in the United States. It's everywhere, and that's what you have to go after. The next thing is, whatever that core group of fans is, and we'll just stay at 1,000, you can expect some attrition to happen. There's always going to be some fans that are dropping off, and there's always going to be some new fans that are coming on. And hopefully, that at least equals out, or you gain some fans throughout the year. And obviously, that's what we want. We want to keep our fan base growing. You certainly don't want it to go down. But you always have to understand that there's going to be fans that are going to drop off, and hopefully they're going to be replaced with new fans. And finally, remember that there's other artists that are competing for those same fans. So there may be only a finite group of fans within the genre of music that you have. And if you're not supplying them with enough product on a timely basis, they may move on. They may move on to your competition. So that's why it's important that if you're counting on your 1,000 true fans to keep you going as your steady source of income, you have to keep supplying them product. You have to keep on giving them a reason for them to be your fans. So That's the 1,000 True Fans theory. It's something that actually works, and it works on any level. You have to develop that core audience, and once you develop that core audience, you have to be able to keep them. Now, let's talk about an audio topic here. A lot of people write in, and they ask me questions about the gear that I use and what my favorite pieces are. So I wrote a blog post about this not that long ago. Well, maybe it was a year ago. And it was very popular. There's a lot of people that liked it. And if you haven't seen that blog post, then let me just give you a little taste of what that was. And basically, it's my 10 favorite microphones. These are the microphones that are my go-to mics that if the studio has them, I'll always use them. So my number one go-to microphone is a U87. I've had a love-hate relationship with an 87 over the years. There's some times where I didn't like the sound at all, and there's other times where I loved it. I'm back in love with it, and I find that it's a really versatile, big-sounding microphone. It may not be the best for everything, but it certainly works for a lot of things, and it's my favorite all-time Tom mic, and it's something I'll always go for if I can get enough of them, and usually that's not the case, but I really like it there. I like it on guitars, and I'll use it whenever I have the opportunity to. My number two favorite mic is the Royer R121, a ribbon mic. And this is a relatively recent mic that's, I think it's only been the last 10 years or so that this has been widely available. But now it's become a standard and every studio has them. And it's certainly one of my favorites. It takes EQ very well. It can be used on a variety of things. Right now it's become a standard sort of on brass for sure because most ribbon mics work really well on it. But also on guitar amps. And you see R121s on guitar amps everywhere. But they also work well on vocals if you're careful. They'll work on acoustic instruments very well, and they just sound natural. So that's one of my go-to microphones. It's number two in my list. Number three is a good old-fashioned AKG 414. And once again, there's a lot of people that don't like 414s, and I can understand why. They're a little on the bright side, or a little on the clean side. But you know what? They're about as good an all-purpose microphone as you can get. They'll work on a variety of things. They work great on cymbals, for instance. They work good on guitars. They work especially good on acoustic guitars and acoustic instruments. I like them a lot, and I'll use them more than I used to, actually. I do like them more. The older I get, the more I like them, I think. Number four is a KM84. And of course, this is an old Neumann mic, Neumann KM84. And you don't see them very often, but it's something that I love to use, especially on snare drum. You'll find that this is something that's sort of common for more of the classic engineers way back when. When they didn't use an SM57, they used a KM84. I can understand why, because it really does sound good on a snare. So when possible, that's what I'll use. If they have a KM184, which is a successor to it, it doesn't sound nearly as good, but I will use that, and I've gotten good results out of that as well. Number five is a Shure SM7B, and that's what I'm speaking on right now. A 7B is an SM57 on steroids. Basically, it was made to be a bigger sounding microphone than a 57 or a 58. What you'll find is, since it's a large capsule dynamic microphone, it's not a condenser mic, it's a dynamic, it works on a lot of different things. It works great on kick drum. It works great on guitars. It works great on bass. And certainly it works great on vocals. It's especially good for scratch vocals because it has some great rejection. So this is one of the microphones that I find I use all the time. Number six is an RE20, which again is an oldie but goodie, and this is one of my favorite kick drum microphones. I really like it on kick, but, you know, again, sometimes this works great on vocals, and it's especially good for a scratch vocal when the vocalist is in the room with the rest of the players during tracking. Number seven is the Shure Beta 57. Now, there's a lot of people that really like the old 57s. I like the newer ones better. I like the Beta 57s, and mostly because of the rejection. It has a little bit more top end as well, and just suits my ears better, and that's something I always go for. On a snare drum, for instance, I like it a lot there. On guitars, I like it. Guitar amps, I should say. It's a really good all-around microphone. Number 8 is a new favorite. It's the Mojave MA300, and this is a large diaphragm condenser microphone, and it's sort of David Royer's version of a U67. I find it to be an extremely versatile microphone, and it's climbing the list the more I use it. Very versatile. Sounds really good on just about anything. Number 9 is the AKG C12. Who doesn't like C12s? And this would be way higher on my list if I can find them more often to use. And once again, unless you're working in the high-end commercial studios, you usually don't find them. And even then, you'll only find one. And many times, if you're in a studio that has like 3 different rooms, you have to fight to get them. But when I can use them, I love it. I just did a session where Ken Scott came in to track for me, and he used it on the bass amp, believe it or not, and it sounded great. And number 10 is kind of a left-field choice here. It's an ADK mic. It's ADK 3 Zigma C12. And basically what it is, it's their version of a C12. It has a capsule that doesn't sound exactly like it, but it gets close enough. And I really do like the sound of it. It's very big and it's very wide. And the price is right. It's certainly a lot cheaper than a normal C12, that's for sure. Then, because they're vintage and you're paying, you know, 5 figures easy for one. So those are my top 10 microphones. These are the mics that I use personally, and I use them all the time. And I use them, I would say, on every session I can get my hands on. It's not to say I won't use other ones and I don't like other ones, but I find that I use these more often than anything else. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I love to hear your comments. My guests today are Chandler and Jay Coyle. Their consulting company is called Music Geek Services, and they help artists reach and stay in touch with their fans. I spoke with Chandler and Jay from Chicago and Nashville via Skype. Jay and Chandler, thank you so much for being on my Inner Circle. It's a pleasure to have you both.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, pleasure.
Tell me about Music Geek Services. How did that get started? What do you do? I've read your website, but just so everybody that's listening kind of gets a feel for what it is that you provide.
Absolutely. And it's kind of funny because, you know, you're not the first. It says, go to your webpage. And some people can see elements of what we do. Other people go, what do you do? And they're confused. And I think, you know, in layman's terms or in an elevator pitch world, we are a direct-to-fan consultancy for bands. But that has morphed over time, and to kind of give you the history and how it was formed. Chandler and I both grew up just omnivorous music fans, addicted to music, both musicians. I'm a drummer, he's a guitarist. Had fans, had been mega fans of the Beatles and of Kiss and of Rush as kids. And that kind of formed our view of how to follow a band and how to love a band and how to support a band. Fast forward to the 90s, and I basically had been in bands and toured with some local bands and was trying to figure out how to do what I felt I understood, which was to serve bands, just didn't know how to do it. So fast forward to 2007, and I got my first official job in the music business, and I use official as in I actually made a living from it, and it was my full-time gig, and that's I joined EMI's Christian Music Group up here in Nashville, Tennessee, in their marketing division, and my role was a non-traditional sales and marketing role. So my job was to look at innovative ways to serve the artists in the underneath the umbrella. And that was a fantastic opportunity to really get inside of where the music business was at that point. It had just gone through Napster. It had gone through the iTunes store taking off. And it was really, it was looking over the slump that they were all fearful of, you know, stealing music is here and what's digital going to mean to all the physical stuff. But there was this bastion of business buzzing in the corner, which was direct to fan, which was being neglected. So I literally I was there for 11 months. And for 11 months, Chandler can attest to this, I was always preaching and always trying to find ways to serve the fans in a direct-to-fan model. And every single thing I pitched and every single thing I talked about to my coworkers and to my bosses, it was almost like, kid, whatever, you run away, you're bothering me. And I was like, oh, this isn't, you know, when I was in there, I was like, oh, this is great. I work for EMI. But in hindsight, it was like the best thing that ever happened to me was I got fired. I got let go.
Laid off, yeah.
Laid off, man. Corporate downsizing, you know, last in, first out. But that literally had me kind of go, okay, what do I do with all this knowledge that I've just amassed over the last 5 years of having friends in full-time bands and pitching them ideas? I was doing consultancy for the Bare Naked Ladies and basically running, for all intents and purposes, running their own record label, which was called Desperation Records, and had confidence with the band and with their management to basically say, I can come in and look at this from a business standpoint, from a record label, how to generate revenue, but then I look at it from a fan's level on what I want to get as a fan of your band. So that was the impetus to start my consultancy, which was Music Geek Management when it initially started. And I was project managing and managing some bands at the time. But one component that was missing was the technological advancement and really the lay of the land in the changes that were happening and how to implement them. So I was trying to find technology, and then I partnered with Chandler. You know, he was working outside of the industry, but yet had the same background as I did as a kid, and saw what I was doing. And he kind of started talking to the tech side of it. And I went, oh, that's the missing piece. I understand the fan. I understand the business part of it, management, project management. But what I was missing was the know-how to implement some of this stuff. And Chandler came on board from having knowledge on how to build web pages and how to implement a direct-to-fan campaign. But more importantly, he came on board and he's seeking out his component to our business is I'm kind of the guy that deals with the bands. I'm the guy that deals with the fans. I'm on the front line. I tour with some of the bands that I work with. I'm in constant contact with the bands in terms of what's next. And then I kind of bring that back to Chandler and say, hey, how do we execute this? Or he'll say, hey, here's some new technology on the landscape. You could probably use this for this client, or maybe this would be a great way to start working with this client. So we kind of partnered in that sense. And that's been going on, I guess, officially, how long has that been going on?
Four years. Yeah, 4 years this month.
Yeah. So right now, the way that
you've been doing 5-6 years as Music Geek, and yeah, then I joined 4 years ago. Yeah.
Correct. And our client base runs the gamut from literally getting tapped to run a campaign for a week for somebody to, hey, can you partner with me? And perfect example is the band Sloan. I started working with them in 2009, band from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, originally from Halifax. They've been around 22 years. And I came on as a, hey, let's bring your business direct to fan. And that became, well, why don't you come on the road with us to, okay, you're part of management now. So that's kind of like, you know, the perfect scenario. And then there's others that it's seasonal, it's cyclical. But I have a small roster of bands that I work pretty regularly with. And then Chandler seems to get kind of the, I don't want to say one-offs, but he gets a lot more of the, hey, can you help us do this? And he'll run and help a band for a couple months or do a quick consultancy with them. So I'm kind of the long-term strategist in terms of sitting down with a band and saying, how do we move your career forward? How do we sustain it? The bands that I currently work with are the Presidents of the United States of America, the band Jars of Clay, the band The Figs, Sloan, and Carbon Leaf. So those are kind of my, every single day I literally wake up and I have a little list next to my computer here. It's like, what are my to-dos for those bands today? And then throughout a year, I might go on the road with, like I'll be out in August with the Presidents, and in October, November, I'll be out with Sloan. And so I do a lot of the direct-to-fan engagement from a merchandising standpoint and actually just, you know, sell merch on road. But that's my marketing and my fan data that I gather is being out in the front line. And then for anybody listening that doesn't understand kind of like a band as a business, most of the business gets done when you're literally sitting in a van or a tour bus and you have nothing else to talk about. And what should we do next? And so one of the nice things that having these bands bring me on the road is, yes, I'm lugging gear and yes, I'm setting up stuff and selling merch. Yep. But when we're traveling, we're literally having, as I call it, a rolling business meeting. So I have a to-do list with the guys that say, okay, hey, let's talk about merchandise. Let's talk about direct-to-fan initiatives. Let's talk about the next album. Let's talk about a live album. Let's talk about what we're not doing. So it becomes this rolling business meeting, which they've kind of come to expect. And then they know that even though I may be based out of Nashville and Chandler might be based out of Chicago, it doesn't really matter where the band's based out of because, you know, in this day and age, it's virtual anyway. So yeah, it's easy to navigate.
When you're using the phrase direct to fan,
mm-hmm.
and What does that mean exactly? I mean, are you talking about all the services from social media to selling merch, or is it just one particular area when you're talking about that? How does that work?
It means different things for different bands based on where they are at in their career. But at the basic level, yeah, direct to fan basically means, just like we're talking right now, it's using that mentality. How am I going to talk and communicate with our fans? And some of it is fan engagement. Using social media, having an email newsletter that you send out to people and communicating with them. And in essence, that's the baseline version of a direct-to-fan, but it becomes more robust when you are selling products exclusively on your website. So the band Sloan, we put out a live bootleg series. We're on the third version of it, where we basically have taken literally a bootleg of one of their shows that a fan had recorded, and we go ahead and master it and edit it and put it onto vinyl, and we make a limited edition version of it.
Great
and we
idea.
Sell it. We don't put it out to iTunes. It's not on Spotify. It's only available if you're on the email list, and we communicate to the fans and say, hey, it's available. And we sell out of everything that we make, which was a great tool for us to basically, to be very candid, it's a generation of revenue for us to keep making it, but it's also for the fans. It's important that the fans are now coming to us, hey, can you do one from this tour? You've done a green vinyl, you've done a white vinyl, you've done a blue vinyl, can you give me an orange vinyl? So it's that kind of, that's the fan engagement and the communication level of a direct to fan at its greatest level. But at its simple level, it could be something that's consulting with there's a client that Chandler and I are in the talks to help right now, a very young green band, and they're just not knowing how to navigate social media and how to even have a presence on the web. So it's building the best practices into their business model that says, oh, I've got to think about how we're presenting ourselves to the fans while we're looking for fans, and then how are we going to communicate with them? So okay. That's direct to fan.
I get right. This now. So Jay, you take care of the front end, and Chandler, you take care of the back end, all the tech stuff, right? Okay.
Well, he usually goes out on tour and comes back with all these ideas, strategic ideas, and I haven't talked to him for weeks when he's out on the road with bad Wi-Fi or whatever, and I'll be like, this happened, and we've got to use this, or who can we use this with? Usually it's like, I have a great idea, and we're trying to figure out which band he can implement some new technology.
Tell me about the technology that you find new and exciting.
Well, I think for us, it seems like old hat, but we both teach with Berklee Online. And through the courses, we talk a lot about building up email lists, as emails, even though it's the oldest digital communications, it's still the most viable way to connect with your fans. It's the only way you can get into their smartphone without annoying them. A text would annoy them, a phone call would annoy them, but an email won't. And for many years, a clipboard at a merch booth was the best way to build an email list, and then or build a mailing list. You know, back when you used to sign your address at a merch booth. But with the advent of, most famously, Topspin's email for media widget, or they'd call it E4M, it allowed bands to put their widget on a website in exchange for a free download, start collecting emails. They would, the smart bands would put together maybe an advanced single or advanced track from an upcoming album, and put together maybe a new front page of their website, and then send all their, announce it on their socials, get their publicist, or if they're not working with a publicist, just ask all their friends to drive traffic and say, get a free track from our new album. And so they're collecting the email addresses. And as time over the last, I guess that sort of came into the forefront from 2008 to 2011, it sort of peaked. Now the big concern is, what do we do to get emails when no one cares about MP3s anymore?
That's a huge thing.
Yeah, it's now it's like they're trying things like BitTorrent is a technology that I'm trying to get someone to use with me. BitTorrent is the technology is peer-to-peer downloading, and it was used by pirates. It's still used. But BitTorrent is a company that is trying to legitimize their business technologies. And one of the things they're offering directly to the music industry is an email for media widget that allows you to give away a ton of content. Like if
they're
you
bundled,
have
right?
Bundle. Yeah, BitTorrent bundles with, like, if you have lossless FLAC or Apple lossless, you know, high quality, even 2496, you can give it all away, and you can gate half of the material behind an email, or you can just give it away. And for now, it's sort of the Wild West there because they're featuring all these bands. So artists like Pretty Lights and Cascade and Amanda Palmer, they're getting hundreds of thousands of downloads. Granted, a baby band may not see the same number, but it's free technology that adds a little twist to the old email for media. The other thing we're seeing is the stuff like shared unlock and what was the thing? Oh, YouTube is a great place where people discover music. Like Led Zeppelin's not streaming on Spotify. Do I get out my Led Zeppelin CDs? No, they're somewhere in the basement. I'll go on YouTube and, you know, usually you can stream it there.
Right.
Well, if you're a band that has any level of fans, they're probably going to put your stuff on YouTube. So you might want to put your stuff on YouTube, but it's a pain to do. Well, now there's a new service that just came out from a guy like us who does digital marketing for bands called artwork.fm. And it basically takes an MP3 file and a cover art file and mushes them together, and then you can upload that to YouTube easily, very quickly, in minutes. And that's the type of like technology where if your fans are going to be searching for you on YouTube,
day and date, there you go.
Because the complaint I get from students in Berkeley is, well, I don't have the money for a music video. And I said, well, do you have the time to put together just artwork videos, which is basically a streaming audio with just the artwork? Bands are doing premieres on YouTube. Queens of the Stone Age put their album, I think first a track and then an album, streaming via YouTube. New Pornographers recently had a big deal about Brill Bruisers or something. There's a new single, and they were streaming it via YouTube. So I know YouTube is planning to have a streaming service at some point, but right now, you know, there are ways to utilize YouTube to your benefit with annotations and all that type of stuff. So that's the type of like the technology is like build awareness and then don't leak opportunities to capture that fan, whether it's an email address or get them to share, you know, give them a reason to share. Likes on Facebook are good, but emails are much better.
You know, I have one for you. So what we all really do online as far as marketing is concerned is we exchange a product for an email address, right? That's kind of the standard in marketing online.
Right.
You give me your email address and I'll give you something in return. I had my AdWords account shut down for that, suspended.
Really?
And they called it email harvesting, and it's against the rules of Google AdWords, believe it or not. And I said to him, look, there's a million marketers that have based their online marketing around this. And they said, yeah, but we're going to catch them all.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, right. Well, they caught me.
Yeah. Yeah. When did that happen?
I've been battling with them over the last 2 weeks.
Wow. Are you serious? So it's really recent.
Yeah.
Wow. It's okay to sell something, but it's not okay to email.
No. Well, actually, I've had them actually shut something down for selling online, telling me that it's a bad user experience trying to sell them something. Now, I'm giving a lot of value, too. I'm selling, for instance, if somebody gives me their email address, I give them a chapter of one of my books, or I give them, you know, a 15-minute video on branding. You know, there's real value that they're getting. And Google has lots of different restraints on those things. I'm finding every single one of them, and it's a drag getting out of prison, Google prison.
I wonder if Facebook has the same situation. We see a lot of bands doing remarketing, which is you drive traffic somewhere where you can set a cookie in the user's browser, and then later when they're on Facebook, Facebook shows them your ad. Jay and I met a guy.
Oh, retargeting, basically.
Yeah. Retargeting. And we met this guy who worked with a couple bands, one of them most famously St. Vincent. So we talked to him about his St. Vincent retargeting campaign and that he did for the label. And it's wonderful because when I see an ad that's relevant to me, and in that case, they were selling downloads to iTunes. So I don't know where that would, but even better, that's an annoying ad to some people. Like, I don't want to buy a download.
Yeah.
But if the ad said stream on Spotify, or if the ad said click here, sign up for her email list and get a free single, or something, you know, so I don't know what, that's weird that I've never heard of AdWords. You know, I ran a campaign on Facebook recently just as a test from personal for my newsletter. And that basically what it was, sign up. So
yeah,
20,000.
Facebook's pretty good. Actually, I've done a lot of advertising on Facebook and it's, you know, it's paid off. It's been pretty good. And, but it's not the same on Google. Let me ask you a question. So, what I've been finding is that we assume that if you're 18 to 21 years old, that you're very, very hip and you know everything there is to know about social media, or at least that's the common assumption. And what I find with musicians in that age group is, just like all musicians, like we are, we're really interested in improving our craft and creating and everything. But they're not as hip on social media as, you know, we've come to expect, or the let's say the collective wisdom says they are. Have you guys found that too?
Well, with the students, I think that a lot of them fall in that age group, although, you know, Berkeley's for all ages. But what I notice is some people in that age group, and I even met some 15-year-olds who struggled, because they're all about hopping to the latest network. And so they're not necessarily looking in a bird's eye view of how do we work Facebook, how do we work Instagram, how do we work Twitter. They're like, Facebook's over, grandma's on there.
Yeah.
And so the other thing is, some artists of all ages, but especially that age, is they don't see it as a commercial. They see a commercial opportunity. They see it as art, and when they have to think about money, it sort of feels weird to them. And then so the natural way they are on Twitter changes to a stilted way, and they feel weird. And that's, I struggled. Actually, one of the first clients that I worked together with, Jay, who's an artist who struggled with anything to do with money related to his music. He felt that the stuff that we were pushing was too commercial, and he didn't want to come off that way. And I still, to this day, meet people who say, "Oh, your ideas are too commercial." I said, "Okay, I'll go work with someone who wants to make money."
Those people still exist?
Yeah.
Gee, I thought that was a product of the 70s.
Yeah,
no. It still exists.
And that's a valid point, too, because there is a, even like going back to your question about what is direct to fan, it means different things to different people. There's a band that I was attempting to help and work, and I won't name them, and I adore them. Great people, haven't been around for a long time, coming back out of retirement. And the second we started talking about the business of it, it was like the dirty word. And they're like, "Oh, we don't feel comfortable in having to kind of deal with that." And more importantly, they didn't feel comfortable letting the fans in. And I was like, "You have to understand, you've been gone from this industry. And the way that you will earn the fans' attention, whether you're a 20-year veteran or a two-week-old veteran, is if you're reaching and speaking directly to the fan." So as Chandler was talking about this one former client of ours, it's like he got the talking to the fan part, but he was like, "Oh, dude, I don't want to have to sell that, and I don't want to put a number to that, and and then it became like this big artistic, you know, struggle of him to try to put value to his art, and that's where I was like, "Oh." And with this other band, it was like they were kicking and screaming into the new millennium, which was, you know, with the advent of social media, people are accessible all the time, and for just as much as this one band was like, "Man, we don't, you know, you're asking for us to do more on social media." And I'm like, "Well, no, I'm asking you to take what you're doing on social media, which was posting pictures and maybe making some comments, but then turn that into something that is a true call to action. That's great that you're back together, and that's great that you're going to go in the studio, but where's your call to action? You're going on tour. Are you telling about the tour? You want to put out a new record? Do a pledge campaign and let them pre-order. So you're generating all this, you know, goodwill with the fan base, but at some point it is a business. And at some point you have to make money or you're not being a good steward to your business.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So what kind of clients do you get? I mean, they obviously have to have money or the ability to make money in order to hire you in the first place, right? So you're not getting brand new artists unless they're coming for money or they have a sponsor or something, right?
Right.
So that means you're basically working with artists that have some sort of at least a minor track record, right? Is that true?
Well, actually, yeah. On the most part, I would say, you know, our sweet spot is definitely a legacy band. Chandler and I were having this discussion this morning. It's like, I have to make sure, we're talking about doing a panel on at South by Southwest next year, and I'm trying to create a panel that kind of blends in what I'm doing for my clients, plus the ways that we both educate to our students within the Berklee Online courses. And I am basically taking all of the experience that I've had over the last 7 years for working with legacy bands and funneling it through the eyes of a baby band that says, yeah, but I've only been around for a year or 2 years and I've never toured outside of my local thing. It's like at the core root, the best practices that we implement can still be applied to a baby band. So to your question, we can still help the younger upstarts bands. But a lot of the times it's more, and I'll use this just from somebody who reached out to me last week. It's like, I talked to her and said flat out, hey, I'm totally available to help you. Do know that I teach this course through Berklee, and if you, it's teaching someone to fish, right? So if you want to do what's right for your career, I think the best avenue for her to take is to get into the Berklee Online course and look at the avenues in which she can focus her career on. But if she wants me to guide her, I said flat out, I said, we charge an hourly rate, but I want to be respectful towards your budget. And I had this one client who said, Jay, I would use you every week, but I can't. I don't have the funds. So let me use you once a month. Oh, great. And then even now she's on hiatus with me because she needs to get some finances. But, you know, there is a respect to those younger artists that I am cognizant that they still need to have money to hire me or consult with me. But I also know I'm teaching them to fish, and my goal is not to make tons of money and live in a big house. In fact, I don't live in a big house, and I've got 3 kids, and I'm the sole breadwinner of the family. So I have to make sure that I'm looking out and protecting my interests. Like you said, you're giving value to people, and that's what I want to do. Chandler and I both talk to a lot of people, and for lack of a better term, I would say we give free consulting to a lot of people at some level. But then if it becomes less than an initial conversation, and then it becomes, well, what can I do exactly? Or, hey, can you help me do this? Absolutely. And it would have to be based on this many hours or this amount of budget. And so that's that weird, awkward situation with some bands where, you know, they're like, why should I've had prospective people say, why should I pay you? Why should I pay you? And I'm like, what are you saying? That's like, would you say to your audience, don't pay a cover charge? And, oh, here, take a t-shirt and a CD, but don't pay me. And this client said, yeah, but just take a percentage down the road, you know, the back end. And I said, look, I can't do that because you can't say with exact certainty that you will have a back end to give me. And I've had situations, sadly, in our time as a company, I've had situations with bands that we separated from because, you know, in talking to them, I was trying to have a conversation with them as a consultant. They were looking at me as a manager, and I said, this isn't working because I can't even manage you because you're already fighting me about a percentage. It's not going to work. You know, you have to trust me in what I'm doing for you. And I'm totally fine with tipping, like with Sloan, it's tipped to a management role, but it's also because they were established, they had revenue, and the day-to-day manager and I basically structured a relationship that he said, you're more valuable to me on my team full-time than part-time. So come on board. And that makes perfect sense.
So you guys do management then?
It's me. You know, I would venture that Chandler does have the opportunity with the experience, and there's an artist local to him that I think he could be the manager for that person. But I never liked, and one of the reasons I was glad to take the moniker off of my business that it's Music Geek Services now, is I find that we do better as a partner to management. We do a lot better with somebody where we can come in and be very candid and say, here's what's broken. And a lot of times if we're looked upon as being the manager, there's a situation where, for whatever reason, there's this little change in the personality where, as a consultant, we're kind of given carte blanche to be direct. But as a manager, you do have to have that, oh, I've got to protect my client. I have to protect their – and it's not their ego. I just have to protect their livelihood and want to stroke them. And I find myself with some of the bands that I work with where It is a gray. I won't mention which band, but there is a gray area with one of my bands, and because of that gray area, it's hard. I can't push them really hard. I can't stick the fire underneath them because I'm not their manager.
Well, when you are brought in, then are you brought in by management or you're brought in by the artist generally?
Both.
Both. Okay. Both. Yeah. So one of the things that you want to tell them is, or you want to discover, is what's broken. What do you find that's normally broken? Is there something that's common in all situations?
Gosh, you know, at the root of that, I do think the thing, and this is just from my experience, what's broken when I talk to a legacy band is the easiest to identify, because to me, for most legacy artists, they have come from a time where everything was taken care of for them, either management or label, right? So they've lived in this world where they did their thing, they did their music, they went on tour, they played their show, and at the end of the day, there was a team of people, label or management, that took care of them. As we've transitioned and the industry has changed drastically, the bands that I consult with on the front end, I'll use the example of the President of the United States of America. Great bunch of guys, adore them. Their drummer is their manager. And when he and I started talking business a year and a half ago, it was very much of a mindset of been there, done that, been burned, negative, kind of downtrodden. And over time, through partnership with him, he's come to realize these great tools that are available to him. And it truly was teaching him to fish. Like, he is the man who's in charge of his email system now. Like, he gets it. And he's, hey, dude, I'm going to send out an email. Can you just look it over and let me know? And I feel like a proud dad. It's like I've taught him how to market his own band that's been around and sold millions of records, right? But what was broken was that, how do I communicate authentically and how do I communicate to our fans that doesn't come off as buy, 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 but more of, hey, dudes, come along for the ride. And he's really gotten that. So to your question, I think what's broken for a lot of established bands is just realizing that the transparency and the engagement part of that doesn't always have to be you only communicate when you're trying to sell somebody. But it's okay to just be yourself, because we came out of an industry where, think about, go back to the 70s, you know, you didn't know when a new record was coming out from a band until the big publicity thing was come out, right? So yeah. I think about being a kid and like we talked about being a huge Kiss fan. It's like, I didn't know what was going on in Kiss's world. There was this, you know, whole, you know, behind the Wizard of Oz curtain. It's a lot of the way that the business was built. So because there wasn't this kind of, hey, come on in and join us, I think some bands, when we initially are consulting with them, we are very huge advocates of the Pledge Music System, and we're huge advocates of going direct to fan for some part of your business. And Sloan's a perfect example. It's like, we do tons of direct to fan business, but we are put out as a record label through Yep Rock and through Outside in Canada. And we have a radio team that pitches our songs to radio. So we've plugged into, quote unquote, the old model. And the easiest thing for the band to get for them was, because they said to me, what was broken was the way for us to communicate to the fans. So we spent the last, 5 years building the mechanism and building the aesthetic internally for them to communicate with their fans. And they do a great job of it now. There's key people in the band that know their role with me is to, okay, what do I say to the fans? When should I say it? And another person is, hey, what products should we be thinking about?
You know, you just talk about Pledge Music there, and let's talk about crowdfunding for a second. One of the things that I've found with crowdfunding with artists, for the most part, is they don't understand it. Now, I've had an artist say, I want to do a crowdfunding campaign, Kickstarter campaign. Well, why do you want to do it? Well, I put so much money in this album, I want to get it back. And it's like, well, wait a second, that's not the reason why you do this. So I've found that a lot of times they've kind of deceived themselves on the purpose of this. And the second thing is they don't have a conception of the tiers that they need in order to make it work, in order to make it attractive for someone to give them some money. So how have you guys dealt with that? How have you done much in that realm?
Oh yeah. And that's, I mean, Chandler and I think, you know, when we started this business, a lot of it was what I would liken to, we were kind of looked upon as the Topspin consultants because we were teaching a lot of people how to use the Topspin media platform. So we were talking about fan engagement, using their email system, and then but we're also talking about the pre-order campaign mentality, which was a, here's our store, and here are maybe our three or four different bundles that you can buy. Hey, it was awesome. It really, it actually was the impetus for Music Geek Service to kind of get a foothold within a consultancy world. But what quickly we found with bands was sometimes that just isn't enough. And sometimes just putting a pre-order on, you basically shot yourself in the foot because you're limiting your ability to sell to 6 weeks or to 4 weeks, right? So I use a band like Carbon Leaf as a perfect example. They've been around for 20 years, and we did, in the same calendar year, we did a Topspin campaign, which generated, these aren't actual numbers, but let's say, in theory, we generated, let's say, $20,000 on this pre-order campaign, okay? And then I will say that when we went through the cycle, which was 9 months later, for their pledge campaign, we basically took a 6 week campaign and made it into a 3 month campaign. So already we basically doubled the time, okay?
For the pledge, it was 3 months, really?
It was 3 months on the pledge.
That's pretty long.
And the way that the pledge operates, and this is a big differentiator, I'm gonna put my pledge hat on for a second.
Yeah.
The differentiator with pledge music over Indiegogo and Kickstarter and all those things, like, you basically have two phases. Phase one is the funding part of it, which is 60 days. So that is very much like a Kickstarter and like an Indiegogo. But the second you hit funding, so whether you hit the 100% within that 60-day window or well before that, or I should say at 60 days or say at 25 days or whatever, it turns into phase two, which was basically then what I call the pre-order campaign. And now you're funding, not even funding anymore, you're just generating revenue to get to the release. So in the Carbon Leaf situation, we hit funding at day 45. So in 45 days, we had sold what we needed to sell in order to generate the money to record, replicate, and release a record. But we then had that's a month and a half, right? So we had another month and a half that we did nothing but pre-order. And we ended up getting to 168 or 169% of our goal. And that was huge. So it was eye-opening. And then internally as a business, right, me and the band said, okay, we've just proven that when you just give your fans a firm window of time and give them only a handful of things to choose from, they don't know any different. They don't know any better. And nothing against the fan. They just, I want this, I'll buy it. Bam. Did really well. I also remember in that time frame that we sold a lot of records, downloads on iTunes the day that it came out. So we did a pre-order campaign on Topspin. We made about $20,000 on Topspin. And then the first week it was out, I remember looking, and we actually charted in the iTunes rock division. We were at like number
Billboard
six.
Too.
And Billboard.
Wow.
So it was a huge, and to me that said, okay, this fan base is ready for it.
No kidding.
But this fan base wants new music. And I went back to the band and said, this is data that we have now. So what we ended up doing was we funneled that into another record in the same calendar year, but did it on pledge. And we about quadrupled the revenue on the pledge campaign. So full disclosure, we're in the process of doing our second pledge campaign for the same band, and we're in it right now. And we have hit a number now that is half of what our total goal was from the last time, but we still have 60 days left. So now I've got 2 full months, and we're going to have 2 stretch goals. We're going to have 150% and a 200% goal. But internally, our goal was higher. Our initial goal was higher on this campaign than the previous one. So the key thing to take away there is we've brought in the revenue that we brought in now is already equating to the revenue that we made on the last one. Does that make sense?
How are you promoting it?
Great question. Right now, it's a diligent, focused, directly to their fan base. So we constantly are communicating via social media and their email.
Constantly means how much?
They actually have an aggressive plan to do a video a day to talk about, and not to talk about the pledge campaign overtly, but like they did, in fact, I will send you, Bobby, they did what I think should be the flagship video for any band that does any type of crowdfunding source. They created a video that shows you what a meet and greet looks like through their eyes. So it's them saying, hey, we have a new pledge campaign up, Carbon Leaf's Indian Summer Revisited 2014. We went ahead and upped our exclusives this time around, and we have they basically said we have the Carbon Leaf meet and greet, and it's a $200 buy-in that you and a friend can come and you basically get treated like royalty. And it's a video of actual fans going through the process at venues.
That's
and
great.
Food,
I love it.
Food and drink. And
what do you and what do you think happened when we put that video up? We've been seeing people buy the VIP pass to their shows on the upcoming tour. We sold out of some dates. We had to add, we had to up some of the allotments for some of the shows. It's like, so when a band takes on the responsibility of doing a crowdfunding or direct-to-fan campaign or a pledge campaign or Indiegogo, whatever you want to call it, whatever mechanism you want to do it, there has to be strategy behind it. And you have to have the band on board 100% because Chandler and I have seen time and time again, best laid plans, and the band doesn't do it, it actually shows up. It's proven. If you don't communicate consistently throughout a campaign, and it doesn't have to be daily, just weekly, if not biweekly, you're missing an opportunity to constantly remind people. Let's put our marketer's hat on, right? How many times in marketing do you have to announce or invite somebody into a process or tell them about a product before they actually buy it? You know, usually it's about four or five times. So if I'm going to send out a message that Carbon Leaf has a new pledge project, I know that it's going to take some time before I get all the people to buy into it. And what's really interesting is to look at the dichotomy between, you know, we've got 16,000 people on their email list. They've got, I think, 25,000 fans on their Facebook. And, you know, we're not near either of those numbers in terms of pledges right now. So right. I know that we've got plenty more to get. But I also know from experience that some people just don't want to buy anything until the record is officially out. And some people now won't even buy it. They'll stream it. But they'll go to your show. And they'll wait till you and they'll wait till the night of the show and they'll show up at the door and pay cover charge at the door. And that's fine. You know, I don't care. But your question directly, it's how do you do it? It's like, that's where the direct-to-fan best practices really comes into play and why Chandler and I are huge advocates for Pledge, because to me it's changed the game for a band to monetize the process. Now you said, Bobby, you said, wow, 3 months is a long time. I can tell you that, you know, there's a process right now we're doing with, based out of Nashville, there's a country star that I've been asked to help with, and she's on Pledge, and her record is, you know, it's she's been in the process for 4 months, I think, and she's still got another 3 months to release. So this is going to be a, you know, a 7 or 8 month campaign.
With Kickstarter, for instance, it's 30 days. And if you go any longer than that, it's kind of pointless because you get most of the traction right in the beginning and right in the end, and it's a dead zone in the middle. So you might as well not even have that 30 days. You know, you could do it shorter if you can. I want to come over to Chandler, though, for a second. So you guys are... You're the top spin experts.
We've been called that, yes.
And top spin has a reputation for being, what would be the word? For being somewhat, I don't want to say difficult to use or difficult to get around, but it's
mysterious.
Mysterious. Yeah. It takes some time and it takes some effort in order to learn it. So does that mean that you're teaching people to do it, or you're doing it yourself, or you're doing it yourself for them? What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think the reason why I got that reputation, two reasons. One, intangible almost. It's they went after the stars like McCartney and David Byrne, and Eminem was an early adopter. And so it worked, but that's in a way I was saying to someone recently that it's almost like shooting fish in a barrel. It's easy. You're you know, if Beyonce drops an album by surprise, she's gonna sell. It's gonna sell like crazy.
Yeah.
But if a band with 120 people on their email list drops an album, it's not so easy. And so when Topspin opened up in 2011, it was cool because suddenly it was available. You didn't have to. It was the most open private beta that I've ever seen, but for a couple of years it had this elusive part about it. Now the difficult part is because I think they didn't really do a good job of making it user friendly from my perspective. Prior to working with Jay, I worked with a software firm that developed a web-based application as content management system and basically membership management system. And user experience for the non-technical person is very important because as one of my former clients would say, if you change the button from red to blue, they'll get confused. And I think Jay remembers the old Tospin because he's the one who showed it to me. And it was a really hard to use system when it was this dark, really confusing system. And it worked once you knew it. And I actually the way I got into Berkeley was I started a blog called Tospin Tips, which was I was trying to share all the information that I would get and try to get it out there. And they, for a while, Tospin had a user forum community, and it was a bunch of us who were trying to share all these tips and tricks and secrets. It was basically we were not hacking, but we were using Tospin often enough that stuff became evident to us that they hadn't well documented. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the other part about it being difficult is Tospin is just a tool. It's not a service. It doesn't promote. We still get, Berkeley canceled the Tospin class actually due to lack of interest in that particular platform. And also around the time that Tospin was laying people off and then getting acquired by Beats and now Band Merch and Cinderblock. Yeah, yeah. But,
I was just going to ask you that, actually.
I'd love to talk about it. It's a hot topic.
I'm just curious if, what's changed since they've gone through two acquisitions.
Jay and I are we're skeptical, but I interact with the people at Tospin, and if they ever listen to this, hi, Nick. hi, Jim. But I think they're overwhelmed. They were handed a really, really useful platform. And if you believe the numbers, Tospin at one time, I think, was quoting 50,000 artist users. I don't know, but I can tell you that Jay watched. I tried to launch sort of a side part of Music Geek Services is saying, well, Tospin refers some people to us for consulting training. There's got to be a lot of people out there who need help to use this. There wasn't. So I don't know if there were as many people using it in the intense way that, say, Sloan uses it, or I can't even think of some other bands that just really pound on Tospin. But for a while, after the merger, it was silence from them. And I think they were just overwhelmed. What I've heard is that they're hiring either hiring developers or, you know, there's things as mechanical as upgrading the programming language that it's based on. And there are some things that they don't know about. They don't have any historical basis. There was some things that I noticed and Jay noticed, but they weren't aware of because they don't have anyone. I think maybe the person who's still there, who stayed through the transition, He's only been with Tospin for maybe a year and a half. So there's no one who's been, I don't think there's anyone who's been there for 5 years who knows all that's under there.
That's scary.
So, you know, it still works, but there are some problems and they're aware of it. Like they have these really cool tools that are useful for power users. And these are the type of things that I would say, Jay, we got to use this. They would allow you to put a streaming player or a widget anywhere. The illusion would be it would be hovering over your YouTube page or hovering over your Facebook page. So you could tweet out a link and it'd say, watch my new video or stream my new single. And the person would click it and they would be hovering and maybe you post that on Twitter and it would be hovering over Twitter. So it felt like they weren't leaving. And so it gave the user the illusion of just momentarily popping up and putting their email address in. The other way that you could use it is watch my new video. And then after they were done watching the video, they were delivered automatically. They could see behind the video the offer page for the new album. We used that a lot when we worked with Rhett Miller of the old 97s. I did a lot of like trying to direct traffic to his offer page so that it's like, hey, watch this video for his new single. And then when they're done watching it, and so you can, if you send them directly to YouTube, you can't really do that or unless you annoy them with annotations. If you send them to your website, there isn't any trick, those power user tools, were very useful, but I don't know if they're going to continue. Jay and I saw some recent changes where the short link, you know, like the bit.ly type link,
yeah,
that they were using one that no longer is integrated. So stats tracking. So right now, I'm going to be talking to Andy Warren, who's one of your listeners. Hi, Andy. Because we're trying to figure out, okay, say Tospin falls apart or disappears, who do we recommend?
Yeah.
And there is no equal, because Tospin, Bandcamp is great.
They have a lot of tools in one place, yeah. And otherwise you have to go to different places to get the same tools.
Bandcamp doesn't offer email.
Yeah.
Reverb Nation is available, but for whatever reason, people feel they outgrow Reverb Nation at a certain level. So if a band with any like aspirations beyond their local scene, Tospin was great because $9 a month and 15% of commissions. So we've been looking at things like Gumroad. What's that other one, Jay, that we just recently heard about?
Limited Run?
Yeah, Limited Run. There's a lot of services.
We just hooked up with SoundScan.
Oh, yeah. Cool. That's good. That's important.
So there's I think right now, while Tospin is busy with their backs turned figuratively to the scene, there's an opportunity for some other service or perhaps services to partner to give a tool set, because every student in the class goes, I want one place to get all this. Where do I go?
Yeah.
And we used to just always say Tospin. But we'll see. I've been told privately by people outside of Tospin that I knew over the years as a Tospin power user to say, be patient. They're working on it and you'll be happy. So my hope is that they are. But in the meantime, my recommendation to students is don't put your stuff in Tospin's warehouse, because if something does happen, you're an artist with 100 t-shirts and 500 CDs in Kentucky and you can't easily move them. However, if you're self-fulfilling and you're on Tospin and you decide to switch to Bandcamp, it's just a day's work or less.
Yeah.
I recently had an artist who said, she's got a side project and she put all that stuff on Tospin. She said, I'm ready to put all the stuff for this other band in Tospin. And I talked her into Bandcamp and she had it up within an hour. It's just like, cause she's self-fulfilling.
That's
not a
easier
problem.
Yeah. You guys have been great today. This has gone a lot longer than these usually go, but
well, there's two of us
only because it's so interesting. So, one last question then. So Jay, what's the best piece of business advice that you've gotten from someone or you've learned?
Wow. No one's ever asked me that question. You know what? I think this just comes from my partner with Sloan, Mike Nelson. When I started out doing what I do as a consultant outside of the record business, it was very much a DIY aesthetic, and it was almost to the detriment to screw the labels. Like, we don't need the labels anymore. Direct to fan is the future. I drink the Tossin' Kool-Aid and said, this is how it's done. The biggest advice that I got from Mike was that's important, but you have to remember that there's a business that's been built out there. And if you want to keep control of your vision and you want to keep control of your masters, you can't do it on your own. You need to find like-minded people to plug into. And I think I've turned that around into the way that I guide people now. If you're a baby band, it's definitely do it on your own and learn all the information that you can. But at some point, it's being mature enough to realize that you can't do everything on your own and you should find like-minded people to plug into. And it's the same thing with technology, with Chandler's point. I come to him a lot of times and say, hey, this is the problem that I have. Is there a current technology that's out there to solve it? Full knowing that I can't rely solely on one technology and I have to be open-minded to, using the advantage of technology to help support my team that I built around. But just that mentality of, I used to preach a lot of do it yourself, and now I've kind of pulled back a little bit and said, it's almost okay to have asking for help. And it's okay to plug into things just as long as you're, at the end of the day, it's serving your career's goals.
Chandler, how about you? The best piece of business advice you've gotten or you've learned?
Well, probably two. In general, always be helpful. Always be, rather than being a taker, try to be a giver, because it'll always come back. But in music specific, like an artist advice is, make sure you have control of all your assets. And I don't mean own your masters. I mean, make sure you know where your email list is. Is it backed up? All the technical stuff, because if you can't log into your website, if your web developer goes AWOL, you know, your SOL. We've seen a big artist lose control of their Facebook page. And so they'd spend, you know, years building up likes, and then they lose control of it to a hacker. So, you know, like, be prepared, have that. These are not just accounts. These are equivalent to your masters. You know, these are your storefronts in some respects.
That's great advice. That's really cool. And it's funny because not a lot of people actually think that way, and they should. So
yeah,
very cool. This has been great, guys. Again, it's been very titillating information for everybody. And it's been very cool. So Jay and Chandler Coyle from Music Geek Services.
Yes.
Thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun, and hopefully we can do this again.
Awesome. Thanks, Bobby. Thanks so much for reaching out. Take care. Bye.
I just want to remind you that both Jay and Chandler teach in the Berklee Music Business Program, so you can hear them more. You can go to Berklee and search out their Music Business Program. If you want to find out more about their company, Music Geek Services, go to musicgeekservices.com. That's Music Geek, G-E-E-K, services.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I really do like your comments. Any questions that you have really help me, so please keep them coming. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He keeps everything going here. He's responsible for all the behind-the-scenes editing. Thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobbio's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or, brand new, on Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you can sign up for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts.